Good afternoon, everybody, and it's great to be with you. I feel like today I finally acclimatized to American kind of context and time. It's taken us 3 days to get over jet lag, so I preached three times yesterday here at Fairview Heights, and the evening service felt like preaching at about 2 o'clock in the morning. It was one of those moments when you have to dig deep and rely on the Spirit of God to do something because you know you've got absolutely nothing left. So today when I woke up and felt human again, that was a really helpful thing. So it's great to be with you. I probably just need to acknowledge that I feel a bit of a fraud standing here at a large church initiative conference, because large in UK context is very different to large in your context. British Methodism, that's the whole of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, only has 4 churches with over 400 members. The whole of that. There's only 4 churches with over 400 members, of which Swanbank that I pastor is one of those 4. So I'm hoping there's going to be some pictures of Swanbank appear on the screen behind me, just to give you a bit of a flavour of who we are. And if all goes well, a picture will appear. And if all doesn't go well, a picture... Oh, here we go. Oh, we're not going to do that. Can we just jump on? Yes, here we are. This is great. The pictures will appear in a minute, I think. Well, oh, I'll come back again. Here are the pictures. We're going to go backwards, Ali, in a second to those statistics. But don't worry. This is Swanbank. This is the church that I pastor. It's in the middle of a city called Stoke-on-Trent, which if you get a map of the UK and put a pin right in the middle, you'll probably hit fairly roughly where we are. If you know anything of the UK, we're kind of 35 miles south of Manchester and 35 miles north of Birmingham, and right in between the two. Some of the images of our church, recognisable, I guess, to you guys. There's worship, it's contemporary worship. There's lots of children's activity, lots of family activity, and lots of engagement with our community. We've grown. When I took over in 2007, there were 316 members. We currently have 441 members. So we have grown each year steadily, but slowly. So we currently have 441 members with an average worshipping congregation of around 500 on a Sunday. So that's the context that I'm coming out of. In our conference, we are currently the largest worshipping congregation in the British Methodist Conference. So I realise that kind of... So when I hear you guys talking of we've just grown to 2,300 and... It kind of makes me go, okay, I think I'm quite a large church in my conference, but here it feels a bit kind of a different animal. But if you know anything about history, you probably understand a bit of that context. I'm going to throw some statistics up on the screen, because as a denomination, our statistics actually make really depressing reading. 1910... we had 841,000 members of the Methodist Church in Britain. By 1968, that had gone to 651,000. By 2010, so look at that jump between 1970 roughly and 2010, we'd gone to 238,000 drop. And 2016, we've just had the figures released in these last few weeks because we do this, we do an annual count of our statistics, and you talked about the metrics, Shane. Our metrics have just been released, 2016. We count October's our month when every Methodist church counts its numbers and it gives us return in. And then we've just released that in 2016, we have dipped under the 200,000 member mark. That's 188,000 members. We have dropped and dropped and dropped. The last generation of our life has not treated us well. Or maybe we've not treated the church well. That may be a whole other conversation we may touch on a little bit. When we start to look at the average age of a Methodist in the UK, those statistics are also available to us. You probably hit the average age of a Methodist currently in the UK is probably around the 70 mark. So if you then project those figures on, even if they have a good few years, project those on 10 years, and we're probably going to lose another half of that 188,000, and we'll probably dip ourselves under 100,000 fairly quickly. Actually, what we face is a bleak future on the face of our statistics. And I guess if somebody was doing a serious statistical analysis, what we actually face is the possibility of a future without the Methodist Church as we currently know it in existence in Britain, which would be very interesting in the home of John Wesley, that the Methodist Church ceased to exist. There's lots of reasons why this is the case. We've not engaged with our changing culture. That's part of the reason. We've kept on doing things the way we have always done them, thinking people will come. We've had that kind of, if we build it, they will come mentality, when the reality is that's just not the case at all. We live in a very post-Christian society. And we live as if we are still in a Christian society where everyone wants to engage with the church. And we've just carried on doing it the way we have always done it and just seen our statistics go lower and lower and lower. You would think at some point that the statistics would be the wake-up call that we need, but we still seem to just keep doing the things the way we've always done them, and we just keep going in the hope that God will do something. One of the other reasons is I think we have not released pioneers well enough in our context to plant new forms of church, to do some radical stuff. We've not trained those pioneers and we've not released those pioneers. We've just trained people to do what we've always done. So when I was trained for ministry 20 odd years ago, I was trained to do what ministers had always done for the last 50 years, even though it was no longer working. And so our conference still seems to be in this cycle of training people for a model of ministry that actually doesn't work. So how is that going to be helpful? And when then we send these ministers out of seminary, having been with us in training for 2 or 3 years, teaching them how to do church that doesn't work, and why do we then get surprised when they go out and it doesn't work? We just have got ourselves into this cycle of a journey that is no longer working and is failing. And so I guess you hear our story a little bit, but the reality is we are in an absolute crisis. For me, one of the key issues is actually we have a real leadership problem. So I entitled the session that I'm doing Leadership Matters, because I think leadership is key. We seem to be averse in our context and in our conference to strong leadership. We've trained some good pastors, but we're not good at identifying, releasing, and training good leaders. We train people who can listen well and get alongside people well, but actually the people they're getting alongside are fewer and fewer and fewer. What we need is some strong leadership that can provide a vision and a direction for us, and our conference currently doesn't seem to identify that or value that. And there are those of us within the conference that are strongly now arguing for identifying and releasing key leaders and visionary leadership across our conference, because that's what we absolutely need. You will know Wesley's statement well, I am sure, where Wesley said, "I'm not afraid that the people called Methodists should ever cease to exist, either in Europe or America. But I am afraid lest they should only exist as a dead sect, having the form of religion without the power." And he goes on to say, "And this undoubtedly will be the case unless they hold fast the doctrine, spirit, and discipline with which they first set out." I think it could be said of us that this concern of Wesley has become our reality. This is exactly where we are. Just before I kick into a number of things I want to say, I want to share two stories with you. The two stories are stories that have shaped my own journey and my own ministry, and they kind of put my journey of ministry into context. The first goes back to before I was ordained as a minister, and I was a youth worker in a church in North Yorkshire. where I kind of cut my teeth a little bit. I went to do a theology degree in one of our universities in the UK. And then when I left university, I was kind of exploring ministry and exploring what God was calling me to do. And I went to work for 3 years as a youth pastor in a church up in the north of England, in quite a rural context. And during that 3 years, the circuit, the area in which I was working had an overseas minister come and spend 6 weeks with them. So we had a guy come from Kenya, a guy named Jacob, came from Kenya and spent 6 weeks with us in the circuit in which I was based. Jacob came from Kenya, where the church that he was a part of was growing rapidly. It was in massive revival. They were kind of struggling to contain it. They couldn't train leaders and teachers and pastors quick enough to contain what God was doing in their midst. It was incredible. And he came to join us in our context, where the church was declining almost as fast as his was growing. It was kind of heading down, and we were struggling, to be really honest. In the midst of all those statistics that I just showed, we're in that kind of 1990, the church was in a decline, down spiral. And Jacob came and spent 6 weeks with us, and he shared our life, and he traveled around the different churches of which we're a part. He kind of lived in our context. He preached. And at the end of the 6 weeks, we had is it potluck supper here? Is that what you guys call it? We call it a faith tea in our context, but a potluck supper where we all bring something. And it's all really exciting because you never quite know what you're going to get. And it's a bit of a shame when everybody brings the same thing, isn't it? But anyway, we have this, the potluck supper, and we had this evening where we had this meal together. And the aim of the evening was to try and hear some reflections from Jacob, to hear how he had seen the 6 weeks and what he'd learnt from it. And during this time of conversation, as he was sharing with us, there was a time of questions, and folk from the floor were asking questions of him. And at one point, one old lady, say old, what I've worked out is as I get older, old gets older. Have you noticed that? Suddenly you kind of, I've now hit this really scary age of 45, where now 50 is nearer than 40. I find this really concerning, and I don't like it very much. But I'm still in denial, actually. I'm 33 in my head. And this lady, she was probably about 60 at the time, but I was young, so she seemed really old. Sorry, I've just offended half the room, haven't I? Sorry, Larry. Sorry, mate. She seemed really old. Anyway, she asked this question of Jacob. She just put her hand up, and she said, Jacob, and I guess she hit the nail on the head, actually. She said, Jacob, can you tell us why your church is growing so rapidly and ours is declining? Can you tell us? He stood for a moment, and then he said these words, and his words have stayed with me and probably shaped a lot of my journey. He said, I have been with you for 6 weeks. I've been in your homes. I've been in your worship spaces. I've been with you in some of your community groups. And he said, outside these four walls, we were in a church context. He said, outside these four walls, I've not heard you mention the name of Jesus once. He said, inside here, you'll sing, you'll do all kinds of stuff. But outside of these four walls, I have not heard you mention the name of Jesus once. He said, why on earth do you expect to grow? He said, back home in Kenya, we talk about Jesus all the time. We know that Jesus has transformed us and transformed everything. And the only hope for many of our people who live in really difficult and broken places, the only hope they have is to come into a relationship with Jesus Christ. I think we have lost that sense. Certainly we have lost that sense in our context, that the only hope our people have is a relationship in Jesus Christ. We no longer hold that. We think it would be nice if they had one, rather than essential that they do and meet their Savior before they die. So that's one story that's kind of just shaped my own journey, and therefore evangelism and mission and helping folk to connect with Jesus Christ is absolute priority to my own journey as a leader in the life of the church. The second is, and it goes back to early in my ordained ministry, I don't know whether you get these. You get letters to go and speak at things and you've no idea where you're going and what you're doing. I have learnt over the years to say no to most of those. In my early days, I was flattered by the invitation. So I kind of said yes to everything and realized I ended up in some bizarre places over the years, in those early years. Now I'm much more selective as to what I say yes to. My wife said not selective enough, but that's by the by. So I got this invitation to go and speak at a church birthday celebration. And it sounded really exciting. And so I wrote back and said, I would be delighted to come and speak at your birthday celebration. And I turned up at this church. It was in quite a rural community, about an hour and a half from where I was living at the time, near Chester in Cheshire. And I drove to it. It was Wednesday night when they had their birthday celebration. I thought it was a bit bizarre, but we went on this Wednesday night, and I turned up. Seemed like the middle of nowhere to me. And I turned up early, and I went into the small room where the minister goes. We called a vestry. Is it called a vestry here? What's it called here? The room where the minister... Office? Coffee shop, okay. Yeah. Anyway, it's a little space at the back of the chapel where nobody else ever goes. It's like the Holy of Holies. And we were in the Holy of Holies with the church, one of the church leaders and stewards. And I began to ask some of the really important things about the service, whether we sing or say the Lord's Prayer, those really essential things we need to get right. And this lady began to tell me how wonderful the church used to be. And she journeyed back about 50 years when this church was in its heyday. When the church was full and the church had hundreds of young people, they probably never did have hundreds of young people, but in her head, this was the reality. She'd grown this story about this church that probably was actually fictional. She began to tell me how wonderful the minister used to be years ago. She had nothing good to say to me about the minister who was in place at that moment. Nothing good at all. In fact, she had nothing good to say to me about the church I was about to walk out into and lead in a celebration. She said, these are her words, there's not many of us left now, about 12. I thought, blimey, why have I come out on a Wednesday night? Should have said no. She said, there's not many of us left now, about 12. And she said, we haven't got long left. She didn't quite say, well, the last one out turned the lights off. But it felt, and I just felt my heart absolutely sink. And I thought two things. As I walked out to lead this service, which I did, I thought two things. The first was, I don't want to be part of a church that has to look back to see something good. I don't want to be part of a church that has to look back to see God doing things. In the British Conference, we have a great heritage. We can look back and see some incredible things. You can journey around the UK and stand in spots where John Wesley spoke and John Wesley slept. You can even touch his bed if you wish to do so. In John Wesley's house, his bed is there. It's great. I'm not convinced it is his bed, but they tell us it is. And you can sit in his chair and you can journey to some of these incredible places about our past where God did incredible things. And I value our story and our heritage and our past, and I am grateful for all that God did. But I don't want to live there. I don't want to have to look back to see God at work. I want God now. I want to see what God's doing in this generation. I want to see the power and the presence of God and the transformation of God in this church. Because God has not changed. Unfortunately, I don't think the church has changed either, and that's the problem. God is constant. The church needs to change. And so I thought, that was the first thing I thought as I walked out. I don't want to be part of a church that has to look back to see God at work. And if you have to look back to see God doing anything in the community of which you're a part, you probably just need to walk out of it. The second thing I thought as I walked out was actually, and there were exactly 12 people. They were all older. She could have probably named them all well in advance because I guess nobody knew had joined their community for years. But I thought, what could God do with 12 people? He's got a bit of a history with that. If they catch a new vision. So what that they are older, actually? It was a fairly retired community. It was an older community. Actually, the Bible talks of people of all ages, doesn't it? I think Joshua was 80 when he pushed on into the promised land. There's no age. What, I guess the difference is what God asks us to do as we journey through those age processes. What he asks me to do when I was 20 is not what he asks me to do when I'm 45. And I guess it's not what he asks me to do when I'm 80. But I hope he keeps asking. And I hope he keeps prompting. And I hope he keeps equipping me for it and helps me catch new vision for that journey and process through life. What can 12 people do if they catch a new vision, catch the sense of the Spirit of God and have a renewed hope in a community? They can transform a community, actually. But they had lost all hope and lost all passion. And I'm fairly confident, I have not checked, but I'm fairly confident that church will be now closed because that's 15 years ago. I'm fairly confident it will be dead and it will be gone. Jacob, how often do you talk about Jesus outside of your walls? And I don't want to be part of a church that has to look back to see God at work. They're the kind of two stories that have significantly shaped my journey as I've journeyed through. I want to suggest 8 habits for us as leaders. That's where I want us to kind of go in the next 15, 20 minutes. I want to suggest 8 habits that I think are absolutely key for us as leaders. If we're going to grow church, if we're going to be part of growing church communities, I think there are some things that need to be our DNA, our core as leaders. And I just want to lay 8 out before you. These are for me, really. These are mine. These certainly work in my context. Whether they all translate across the pond, we're about to find out. Take what works and ditch what doesn't. That's fine by me. Okay, if you think that doesn't work this side of the pond, just let it go and stop on something else. That's okay. First is this. This must work this side of the pond. Habit number 1 is continue to grow in our covenant relationship with God as leaders. Surely key for us. We know it deep down, but how often does it get neglected because other things push us or take our time? Our church, the church that we lead, needs us to invest time in our relationship with Jesus. The church that you lead should demand of you that you're investing time in your relationship with Jesus. Actually, when you start your week, that space needs to be your priority above everything else. Because if we are not growing in our relationship with Jesus and we're not modeling that discipleship journey, if we're not modeling that time with Father God as important to us, how on earth are our people ever going to catch that? Shane talked about discipleship as being key. If we're not modeling that discipleship process of a growing individual, how on earth are our people ever going to do that? And how on earth is the church ever going to grow? We need to model a rhythm of discipleship that is healthy and sees us continually deepening and growing in our relationship with Jesus. Can your congregation, can your people see you? Is it evident in you, that relationship with Jesus that's growing? Is it visible? 2 questions. Can I ask you to take 30 seconds to think? Is that all right? And to talk just where you are? Not sure how this works if we're recording something, but that's by the by. First is, what leads us as leaders to neglect our relationship with God? And sometimes I guess that's the church. And the second question is, what helps us grow in our relationship with God? And I guess sometimes that's the church. It can do both. Just where you are for you as a leader right now, in your context, where you find yourself, what actually helps you neglect your relationship with God? What leads you to neglect it? Let's have some honesty. And what helps you to grow in your relationship with God? Just 30 seconds. Let me just turn to the person next to you and just bounce a couple of things off. What leads you to neglect your growing relationship with God and what helps you in that? Just bounce a few things across. Okay, let's just pull back together. You need a lot more seconds. Can we just throw out 2 or 3 from the floor? What leads you to neglect relationship with God? Anybody going to be honest with us and just throw 1 or 2 out? The act of leading. Agreed. Any others? Busyness.
The mundane.
The mundane. Being really blunt, I just have to remind myself that I control my own diary. Nobody controls my diary other than me. And if those things go out of the window, who do I blame for that? If the core things go out, I have to take responsibility for that. And so it's that discipline process of making sure that relationship with Jesus is core to my diary, actually. Because I live by my diary. And I diary it in. Okay, we'll journey on. Second habit. This is probably... is the phrase teaching granny to suck eggs a phrase in the States? No. That's new. We have a phrase. Okay.
We like it.
Let me teach you a new phrase, okay? Are you ready for this then? You can use this now. This is a gift. This is a gift to you. Teaching granny to suck eggs is a phrase teaching somebody something they already know and know really well. Okay, so... Pardon? But it's all to do because granny has no teeth, of course. So, I feel like this session has gone downhill very quickly. Okay, just forget the last 2 minutes actually happened. We'll journey back. I realise I'm teaching you something you already know. Prayer. As leaders seeking to grow the church, prayer is absolutely essential to our journey. There is no way around it, and there is no shortcut. I remember I got the opportunity a while ago to, when the World Methodist Council held its meeting in South Korea, to go as a rep from the UK to the World Methodist Council. Of course, in Korea, you've got the largest church in the world, but also the largest Methodist church in the world. That has around 300,000 members. So you think yours is big. Fancy the logistics of that one. They meet in this massive auditorium and have services at 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock and 9 o'clock and journey through the Sunday. So you're fairly done after that when you've preached all of those. And then after the first service, some Koreans on little mopeds take a DVD of the first service out to all their little satellite places so the churches around the city can then share in the pastor's message from the Sunday morning. And it just is. And every night, they have a prayer meeting. Pastor Hong Do Kim, who planted the church in 1973, planted the church with 75 members. We got to have a conversation with him, and somebody asked him about the strategy for growth. What's the strategy? What was the strategy when you started off? He didn't have a lot of English, but he said this. He said, no earnest prayer, no church growth. No earnest prayer, no church growth. And so they pray, actually they pray every night. They start at 10 p.m. and finish at 3 o'clock in the morning. Every night of the week. We join them for one of their prayer meetings where 25,000 people every night join to pray. It's Korean-style prayer, which means everybody just goes for it all at the same time. And at 10 o'clock, whoever was leading it hit a button, a little bell thing, and these Koreans all just started praying, all at the top of their own voices, all just going for it, for 5 hours. I had about 7 cups of coffee in that period of time, but they just kept going. Until 3 o'clock in the morning when the bell was then hit again and everybody stopped suddenly. It was silent. It was bizarre. And everybody just left. Within 5 minutes, the place was empty. But they had prayed, and what they pray for is the lost and the broken and their community and their church leadership, and they just pray. What you also need to know is they have a staff of 650 clergy. They have to be there at least twice a week. It's the deal. You're seen to be praying with your community. You're visible with your community. You're praying for the lost and the broken of your community. It's part of your rhythm of leadership and life in the church. And he says, actually, that's our strategy. That's the strategy. We pray. We seek God. We come before God and we do it again and again and again. And as leaders, are we modeling, because I'm not convinced we are in our context, are we modeling a commitment to passionate prayer for the lost and the broken? In the UK, if you start to talk about church prayer meetings, everyone just switches off. We have lost somewhere in that journey of the last 50 years our desire and our heart and our passion to pray for the broken and the lost and the least and the lowest of our communities. We'll turn out for all kinds of things. We'll turn out for bingo and we'll turn out for bazaars and we'll turn out for a concert. But the minute we say we're going to church, let's pray, we can have nobody there. We've lost someone on the way. And partly as leaders, we just need to model it and we need to keep modeling it and we need to keep doing it until our folk catch the vision and see the passion. Prayer is a sign that our intention in joining in God's mission is to see people come to faith in Jesus Christ. And there is no shortcut. If you go back to any of the revivals in the UK and some of the Methodist revivals, you will journey them all back to prayer, all of them. In 1807, we had what's called the Primitive Methodist Revival in the UK. You probably don't, some of our history is out, there were a number of different Methodist strands that grew up over the years. We had the Wesleyan strand, and then that became too kind of middle class for some people, and then this new movement grew up called the Primitive Methodists. And that grew from a great revival in 1807 where two men, Hugh Bourne and William Clowes, started some open-air camp meetings on a place called Mow Cop, which is about 5 miles from where I live currently. And this grew into a massive revival that shook the nation. Actually, we talk about Hugh Bourne and William Clowes being the two people who started that revival under God. That is not true, actually. They were the two figureheads of something. But if you journey back before that, you find a small house in Harrisey Head where about 7 women and a woman opened her house. And 7 women had prayed for years and years and years to see revival in their community. Jane Hall, her name was, in this little house where she said, let's just pray. She modeled something that eventually God's Spirit just took and used. But there was no shortcut because they, for years, just kept praying. So as leaders, I'm not going to get you to discuss this, don't worry. But I do want you to think, how often do you pray for the lost in your community? When was the last time you, as a leader, specifically took time to pray for the lost around you in your church? And is that something you do on a regular basis? Or just something you do occasionally? Just give you a moment to think. What about you? Not how often do you tell others to do it, because we're good at that, aren't we? But you. Okay, no more to teaching Granny to suck eggs. We're moving on. Three. The other habit, I think, is authenticity. Being real. I think one of the keys for us right now in the church in the UK is integrity. People are wary of institution. Full stop. Institution of all kinds. That's why we see Brexit happen. And I'm guessing you've seen the Brexit stuff on your news. We have a complete and utter distrust of big institutions and big organisations because we see the battles, we see the lies, we see the politics, and we see the division that is caused by those institutions. And so actually we say we don't want to touch that at all. Actually, that's the story of the church for us in the UK too. We are one of those institutions. We are in the middle of, I say this really carefully, because it's probably the elephant in the room. We are in the middle of a battle about sexuality. As are you, if my reading of Facebook is right. And the world kind of tars us with that, because that's all the world sees. They see the battle and the scars and the bruises that we do to each other and think that represents the gospel, sadly. And the mission of God is diminished and hindered by those scars. Because what the world actually want to see, and they rarely see it through our church and our context, is what a real relationship with Jesus looks like. That's what they want to see. The Christian community witnesses to Christ through who we are much more powerfully than what we say. Who we are matters more than the words that come out of our mouths. How we live together, how we confer together, how we differ actually needs to be gospel at every point. And that is really hard when those differences seem poles apart. But the world is watching to see how we do gospel in that. I say to my wife on a regular basis, as I preach most weeks in the church that I am in, I give her permission, and she does, she takes it as well. I give her permission, I wish she didn't at times. I give her permission to say, actually this morning you weren't real on that platform. It wasn't you. You were trying to be something you're not. Because I think what our people need is to see a relationship with Jesus that's lived out through the preaching of Scripture, through relationship with your community. They don't need a fake standing on a platform as trying to be somebody else. They need you, authentically you, with all your brokenness and all your pain and all the issues that you carry with you, as that's part of who you are. And actually the people need to see you and how you live with Jesus through those difficult journeys of life, actually. If we try and be this perfect leader that has this veneer that no one can get through, that does a disservice to the gospel too. Because the way a lot of our people deal with their pain is to see Jesus working through ours as we are honest before them in our preaching of the gospel and our living out of our discipleship. We've got to be real with our people. If your life is messy and hard, don't try and hide that. But allow that to come through in your relationships with your people. Actually, that means being really vulnerable. And that can be really difficult and hard too. Because as leaders, often we try not to be vulnerable. Habit 4. I'm running out of time. I'll go much quicker. Habit 4 for me as a leader is about loving your community. Actually, for me, this is effective. It's absolutely necessary to be effective in building kingdom in the context in which you find yourself. Again, there is no shortcut around this. Evangelism and mission happens best in a community that knows you, a community in which you've earned respect and earned the right to speak and to communicate. In the UK, the church used to be at the centre of its community. It used to have a voice in the public arena, in the public square. It used to have a voice in the political world. Actually, we have now lost all of that in the UK. The church doesn't have a right to speak anymore. The church's voice is marginalised. The church's voice is on the edge of all things. And the world happens without the church's engagement in most communities now in the UK. The church has little influence in the halls of power anymore. And we have a real task in earning the right to speak again into our communities. Somebody once asked me, I'm sorry to the English guys who've heard me say this before, somebody once asked me, what the success of Swan Bank was. Actually, I hate the word success, but that was the word that they used. So I use the word here. So they said, what's the success of Swan Bank? And we were walking from Methodist Church House, which is in London. It's the kind of our conference office in London. And it's about a 20-minute walk to the train station that we were both getting to head back north. And it took me probably the 20-minute journey to work out my answer to the question, because I wasn't totally sure. But as I walked and I reflected and I thought, yes, no, I do know the answer to this question. The success for Swan Bank for me is that over 10 years, I have fallen in love with my community. I am passionate about the community in which I live. It's people. And I spend most of my time beyond the walls of our church. I'm part of something called the Burslem. That's the little community in which I find myself. The Burslem Regeneration Company, which is all about regeneration of our town and investment in our town. I work with all the business leaders and all the community leaders. We do business breakfasts together. And I'm so rooted in our community. And I tell our congregation, let's be out and visible. And so we run food banks. And when the library closed down in our town, we said, let's invest in the library and let's us start a library for our community. Let's be. So we've worked so hard to love our community, to be rooted in our community, to be engaged with our community, that the success for us is simply that when anyone within a 2 or 3 mile radius of our building has a problem, whatever it may be, whether I'm hungry, whether I don't know how, I've just my relationship's broken down and I'm now on my own with children, where do I turn? To I've got a question about faith, that the first thing in all of those contexts, the first thing they think about and where to go is to Swan Bank. Where can I turn? The first place, the top of the list, is us. And every time we will meet, and every time we will engage, and every time we will love, because I know that our community know that we love them, just for being them. Not because we're seeking to convert them, although of course we would love to do that, but simply because we love our community and it's part of our heart. And I think as leaders, if we don't love the community in which we find ourselves, we're going to have a problem. We have to love those around us. And as we love people and as we serve people and as we care for people and as we commit to people and as we're vulnerable with people, we earn the right to actually talk about Jesus in that mix. We earn the right to say, now let me just share something with you about who I am and why I am. And that's about Jesus. We don't automatically have the right in our context anymore to do that straight off. We have to earn that right. 5. I've got 6 minutes to do 4. So let's go. Because you need dinner. 5, spiritual conversation. Peter says in the letter, doesn't he? Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. We need to model sharing our story. We tell our people, you need to do mission, you need to do evangelism, you need to talk about Jesus. Actually, what we need to model is the sharing of our story of faith. Because the greatest tool the church has is not programs and strategy, but our people's stories of faith. That's the greatest tool the church has. In our context, and in the church in which I find myself with 500 people, I'm constantly saying the best tool this church has is your story of I once was lost, but now I'm found. Your story, I was blind, but now I see. Your story of I was broken and lost, but look what Jesus has done for me. That is the greatest tool, and we have to model that. We have to be constantly telling our story of faith with our people, and they need to see us do that in our context as well. That we are not afraid or embarrassed by or scared of our story and our journey. And we model that with others. So I'll just quickly move on. Spiritual conversations. We need to help people to move from being silent and scared to sharing their story again and again and again in all kinds of contexts. And we do that by modeling our own. When was the last time in your context you shared your story of faith with someone who did not know Jesus? You need to be doing that all the time. Are we 6? 6. marking moments. Leaders need to help communities to mark key moments, providing the liturgy and the language to help people move through their journey. I can think of two significant moments when in the UK, church attendance following this event was up the following Sunday. The death of Princess Diana was one. She actually died on a Sunday morning. But the following Sunday, church attendance in the UK, right across the board, was up. Because folk are in that moment going, how do I deal with this? And the other, of course, was 9/11. I'm guessing it was the same in this context. But certainly in our context, even though this was on the other side of the pond, the impact on us from that event meant, again, the following Sunday, church attendance shot. Because where do people turn? And we have to be ready to help people to mark key moments and provide the language, the liturgy, the space to find Jesus in those. And you'll have your moments in your own community when it's absolutely right that you as a leader take that time to say, let's mark this. This is significant for our community. I can think of a number in our own context where we've just stopped and said, we need to find language for our community. And I as a leader have to model something here that says I need to provide language to help our community move and to journey. Seven, I'll fly us on. Moving it on. There comes a moment in our journey as leaders where we have to just recognize that we can't stay where we are. Something needs to change. Actually, more leaders in the UK need to recognize this right now. We've got too many people in the UK in leadership who are just keeping things ticking over as they have always been. And there needs to be a radical change, and they need to just say, we cannot stay here. We need to move there. But we are too scared to make that shift and that jump because it's painful. We like to be liked, don't we, I guess. There's something in us that craves that sense of everyone loving me. And while we're maintaining the status quo, that's actually often possible. Everyone loves us, but we're not doing what God requires of us. What's more important in that mix? And the minute we start to push and the minute we start to move it on and initiate change, well, we know, don't we, that the pain comes with that. And so I, in our context, there are too many ministers who are just happy to maintain status quo, to be loved by their people, but to ignore the call of God on them as leaders. I hope and pray you're not in that mold. Because we need some leaders who are prepared to be vulnerable, to take the hit, and to move the church on. Fine, I know too many leaders who recognize what they need to do, but just don't do it for fear of what people might say. Who are we trying to please? Whose delight do we want to receive? Final one, invitation. Significant part of the work of a leader is modeling invitation. I am absolutely convinced that in our community, there are people waiting to receive an invitation, not just to come to church, but to come to a relationship with Jesus Christ. But they're waiting. They're waiting for invitation to do that. They may be scared of just stepping over. They may not know what's beyond, but they're waiting for the invitation. Actually, we need to model that constant inviting people too. We need to model being the people who say, why don't you? And actually, we need to be constantly inviting. When was the last time you invited folk in your family who don't know Christ to come to something? Or in your community who you know, in your workplaces who you know? We need to model that all the time because our people are not going to do that if we're not modeling it. They will often look at us and do just as we are. And if we have bad leaders, we create unhealthy congregation. We need healthy leaders who have a DNA and habits that bring about transformation and change. And I believe these eight things will help us to do that. It's 5 o'clock. I'm going to stop. But I will end with a Wesley quote, just to conclude. Wesley said, you will know this really well. John Wesley said, give me 100 men and women. He didn't say that bit, but we'll just include them in right now, just so I don't get lynched on the way out. Give me 100 people who fear nothing but sin and desire nothing but God, and I care not whether they're clergymen or laymen. They alone will shake the gates of hell and set up the kingdom of heaven upon the earth. The UK needs those men and women. The UK needs some men and women who care nothing but love of Jesus Christ, who desire nothing but to serve him, who are sensitive to the prompting and the calling of the Spirit, and are prepared to stand strong as leaders in the church. I think you probably need that too, actually. And I'll stop just there. Thanks.